was John Cleary on ABC Local Radio and on Radio Australia.
And right now on Sunday night, it's a pleasure to welcome into our Sunday night studios one of the world's most talked about philosophers of the last couple of decades. With books such as Sources of the Self and A Secular Age, Canadian Professor Charles Taylor has succeeded in provoking renewed debate and fresh insight into what many had come to regard as settled turf. From the nature of the human person to the continuing place of religion. He's been in Australia as a guest of the Australian Catholic University to officially launch their Institute of Social Justice. Charles Taylor, welcome to Sunday Nights.
Thank you very much.
Charles Taylor, you're visiting Australia at a very interesting time. In the midst of an election campaign and with the background of some turbulence in electoral politics both in the United States and the United Kingdom, centred in some part on a renewed debate on the nature of the good society.
A propitious time and a very scary time, you know, because we seem to be moving away from democracy as a kind of, you know, the obvious solution, and we seem to be moving away from multicultural societies with openness and mutual understanding as the basic understanding of everything. Look at the United States. You have this guy who's campaigning against Muslims. It's something, if you told me that 3 years ago, I would just, you know, I would never believe.
And there's a sort of global defensiveness.
Exactly. That's one example. But then you have, you know, in the European Union, you have Poland, you have Hungary turning in this direction. Turkey is turning away from democracy and once more having a fight with their Kurdish minority. You can go on and on. I mean, they don't know exactly where you stop. You know, a few years ago, we were all saying, oh, yeah, democracy's on the march. It's the end of the wall.
The end of history.
The end of history. Some poor guy. He must be hiding. He almost just be hiding somewhere under a pillow. The end. But, you know, it's now moving backwards in a very frightening democratic point of view.
All of this touches on one of your continuing themes. That's the problems inherent in what's been a pervasive reductionist individualism that's become the default position over the past 30 years in civil society. It's assumed that that's the settled is.
Exactly. And I mean, that comes out in neoliberal economics, right? And neoliberal economics has put us in a terrible jam, not only the 2008, you know, collapse, but also our societies are becoming ungovernable because they just aren't taxing themselves enough. That sounds scary to people, but a hell of a lot of money just escapes entirely from the tax net, like all these corporations that, you know, have their profit in the Cayman Islands, and then the individuals, you know, we know from Panama that. So we have growing inequality, growing dissatisfaction in these societies, and the societies are incapable of meeting that while they stick with this neoliberal dream that we don't need to be taxed any further and just leave it to the
That's why we see people like Jeremy Corbyn in the UK and Bernie Sanders the United States, both elder men harking back to an earlier era.
Yeah, and both, I don't know the British case, but in Bernie Sanders, a lot of young people just flocking to his standard. It's extraordinary. He's one of the most, you know, I don't think he's going to beat Hillary, but starting from nowhere, that's really something very remarkable.
What is it that's resonating there, do you reckon?
Oh, what's resonating is a sense that things are going gradually out of control and we can't do anything about it. And then someone comes along and gives you the hope, yeah, we can, right? You know, the slogan of Obama was, yes, we can, right? And it's that, in a situation where people feel very powerless, if somebody, credibly, at least to them, says, yes, we can follow this program and so on, people flock to it.
And that's what allows the Donald Trump to stand on the same stage as the Bernie Sanders.
That's right. But now that you see, there are two programs that people say we've got to overturn, these elites and so on. One is the program of exclusion, because a lot of people have, you know, a lot of discomfort with new foreigners or with maybe old groups that they don't think highly of, and they've been told for 20, 30 years, shut up about that. We live in an open society. We got to, you know, tolerate each other, understand each other. And then along comes Donald Trump and says, no, you don't. You don't have to do it. You can let all your prejudices go. And on the other side, we have people that feel, yeah, the whole society isn't really giving us a break. It's not opening new avenues for us. The middle class, people are falling out of the middle class. And that's where the Bernie Sanders and, well, Obama a few years ago come in.
For much of the past 30 years, as we've mentioned, this has had its focus on economics and the way played out in our society. But it's been bolstered by philosophic arguments that go back to John Locke and the Enlightenment, that go back, well, through positivism in the 1950s as a philosophy. But they've been buttressed most recently with semi-scientific arguments of people like Richard Dawkins and the selfish gene.
Yeah.
And it all seems to have almost reached an apotheosis here.
Yeah, I mean, it's become the common, you know, the common sense of the age. But I mean, you take Dawkins, all the people I know who really have a very deep knowledge of genes and evolution say the idea of a single gene following a single gene is against the whole complex of genes that affect each other. Just doesn't wash. So the idea of following the gene, it's only because it looks like following the individual. Right?
And paradoxically, right at the moment, over recent months, we've had another book coming out saying the key to understanding our genetic success is an altruistic gene, a community building gene. That is, unless we live together, we fail.
Yeah. I mean, that's been obvious for a long time. We didn't need genetics to tell us that.
You spent a lot of time writing about this, and I've mentioned two of your books that most centered around this, the sense of this, what the self is, who the self is, and in 2007, then a book which took this seriously, A Secular Age. Because a lot of people have posited that look, we were held together by bonds that were religious up until perhaps the Enlightenment, and then it all fell away, and in some ways religion has fallen away, but we're going through a transition stage to a sort of more sunlit uplands where we don't need religion. You're suggesting that, look, it is more complex than that. Some of those trends are happening, but religare, the ties that bind, that discussion is still an essential part of what we need to deal with, particularly in an age like this.
Yeah. Because, you see, religion isn't disappearing. It was never disappearing, but it is mutating. Because, anyway, we from European-type societies, includes you, you know, though you're displaced rather away from the... But they were, go 100 years back, they were all bonded together by common religion, maybe different denominations here in the States, but common religion. And everybody belongs to one or other church or to the national church. And what we have in the 21st century is a complete shattering of that religious unity. And people are becoming searchers. Young people want to find some spiritual path, and it's not necessarily religious. So we have the kind of religious plurality and pluralism that, for instance, a country like India has always had. Right? So we can't be bonded by that anymore. But we have developed a notion of democracy where we have a very strong sense of solidarity, and that turns around national identities. I mean, the national identities are also around principles like the principles of democracy and equal rights. And it's that which is being loosened up by a recurrence of this old myth that we don't need bonding because we have automatic mechanisms. You know, the idea of, in a way, the vulgarization of Adam Smith. If you try to, you know, do the best by yourself and just work out by an invisible hand, that you'll help everyone else. And that's since the 1970s and 80s, since Reagan and Thatcher, to take two great names, that idea has returned very powerfully, and it's just not a bonding proper for society.
Many people point to the two clichés uttered by both those individuals, Margaret Thatcher's "there's no such thing in society" and Ronald Reagan's "government is the problem." You're suggesting that there is a far deeper analysis of those concepts. They weren't just economic statements or statements about a particular moment in time. They betoken a view of the world that has a depth and a consistency about it. It just happens to be inappropriate.
Well, it happens to be deeply false. Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. Yeah, I mean, the idea that some mechanism is going to take care of all this, if we just liberate people.
The magic of the market.
The magic of the market, yeah. And it just doesn't end up working that way. We have Ronald Reagan, government is the problem. All these people in the States keep repeating that. But these same people, they're relying on the state every day. They're relying on the state to build the roads, to build the bridges, to build the tunnels, to build the railways, to bring their stuff to market, and relying on it to educate the people that are going to be the workforce. So you have this very strange doublethink that these people have. It's very hard to put your
Yet they idealize the founding fathers who created a state.
A state, very much so. And, you know,
almost a perfect state.
Yeah. And someone like Alexander Hamilton was, you know, a great, if you like, manager from the central state. He wanted to have a central bank and manage things. So it wasn't anything to do with that. No, this started in a way in the 19th century with the great Robert Barons, and then the pendulum swung once more to some kind of collective provision with Roosevelt and others. And now it's swinging back, and it's disastrous because, as a matter of fact, in the United States, very concretely, the infrastructure is falling apart, and they won't raise the taxes.
Philosophically, where do you trace the seeds of this to? Do you say, as some do, it's all the fault of the Enlightenment? If we get rid of that, we'd be back into a healthier, more comfortable way of viewing the world.
No, I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, there are lots of great things in the Enlightenment. Anyway, the Enlightenment isn't a single thing. There are all sorts of different philosophies behind the Enlightenment. You know, there's Rousseau and there's Locke and there's a great number. No, anyway, we can't undo a lot of the stuff that's been done. But, you know, history is this. It goes like this, I think. It gives you a challenge to rediscover new ways of bonding together societies. If you like. I mean, it can no longer be a common religion. It has to be a common ethos, and the ethos has to be embedded in something we all feel we want to belong to, our national state or European Union, maybe, if you can get that. Now, you've got to recover that. You
know. That's been the struggle of the last century in a way, though, hasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean,
we
went from the highly communitarian views of right and left, where you had fascism and communism saying we need something to supplant religion in a way, to now a sort of extreme libertarianism, both on the left and the right, paradoxically.
Yeah, that's right. And it's been greatly liberating. You see, allowing individuals to discover themselves. You know, we have an ethic of what I want to call authenticity, the idea that every human being has their own way of being human, and they should be allowed to discover it and develop it and not be discriminated against because of it. But that only works with a very strong sense of solidarity, being bonded together in solidarity. Now, you know, the basis of this is there. When all these kids go out to Occupy or Quince de Mayo in Spain and they rebel against this kind of austerity and so on, these are the same kids that believe in authenticity, individual self-expression. We mustn't discriminate against our friend because he's, you know, either gay or what have you. The same people can be molded together in this kind of solidarity. And that's where we need great political leadership.
You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. Our guest is Canadian philosopher Professor Charles Taylor, or I should say really a citizen of the world because you've occupied chairs in both the UK and Canada. He's in Australia for the Australian Catholic University to launch the Institute of Social Justice. He's our guest on Sunday night. Charles Taylor, let's talk for a moment about what makes the individual. Is the individual an autonomous unit? What creates the individual?
Well, there has to be a whole culture which encourages and gives value to the individual discovering his or her path, right? So, that's one kind of individualism. You know, in our modern development of European culture, we've had several kinds. One is a kind of the self-interested entrepreneur pushing ahead, which can be very valuable in its own way. Then there's the idea of individual who's responsible for himself or herself. But in the last, let's say, half century, we have generalized this notion that individuals have to find themselves and find a way of realizing themselves. Now, that whole culture opens up the possibility of individualism in a way which, let's say, people in very much earlier societies, you were a woman, a boy, an old man, your role was kind of already, the script was written for you.
In fact, it almost seems that at every level that individualism has been pursued, at its foundation, it's flawed. That is, if you take an economic concept like the market is an artificial construction. It's a construction of a certain way of viewing the world. That anthropologically, the nature of an individual human is just empirically not true. That philosophically, the Lockean view, or the radical interpretation of the Lockean view, the individual, is flawed philosophically from your point of view. It's basically they're pushed too far? Is that the...
Well, no, it's forged, philosophically, but it's forged really culturally, because unless these philosophies are realized in a whole culture, they just are something that some person is thinking somewhere. No one listens. I'm a philosopher. I know there are also those things that people don't pick up on that I think are very smart on my part. So it has to be woven into a culture. And we've developed these cultures in which, in particular, this idea of becoming your own person is very, very powerful. And that is something so utterly different from the way people have usually lived in history, where we have these rules that are more or less fixed.
And in fact, we emerged as humans in community.
Yes.
That is, we evolved.
That's right. And we only will go on evolving in communities. You see, there has to be a community holding this culture together, sustaining each other in this culture, or it's going to break apart completely, and it won't be a viable home for people anymore. So we never lose that importance of the community.
There's a rethinking going on in economics. You could see it in the works of the last 12 months of people like Thomas Piketty and others.
Yeah.
You see it in the writings, interestingly enough, first of all emerging out of the conservative tradition. That is, conservatives began to critique neoliberalism.
Yeah.
And you get writers like David Brooks at the New York Times.
Yeah.
And to discuss what it means to be part of society.
That's right. And there is a very, in Canada, you have a very vigorous conservative tradition for a long time, which had this kind of wisdom before the Conservative Party was taken over by these American neocons, more or less, with their neoliberal outlook. So we're very, very familiar with that in Canada, that other stream of thought. We've all been nourished by it, people like George Grant and others. Those of us on the left, I'm a social democrat, but these people are important.
In some ways it harkens back, or it's used in conservative politics, it almost harkened back to an old high Tory view that noblesse oblige. We have responsibilities to our neighbours.
Yeah.
And I, as the one who has been blessed, has an obligation to share, no matter how my blessings come to me.
there's certain problems with that, but the citizen has obligations. The citizen has duties.
So both left and right have to move away from a radically libertarian individualist view.
Exactly. It's an incomplete basis for a civilized society, and it'll break up. It'll collapse in one way or another if we don't do that, if we don't find a way coming together again.
How do you find coherence?
Well, you see, I think we have this kind of ideal of a society in which we are bonded because we cherish this kind of freedom and difference in individuality, and so we'll stand behind each other in the search for it, right? We'll stand beside and behind each other in the search for it.
But you can find that in extreme communitarian views. We've already alluded to fascism and communism of being the right and left of communitarian views.
Yeah,
focused.
Yeah, but they're not bonded by any kind of ideology. They're bonded by ultimately the police. I mean, there's originally a justifying ideology like in communism, which was some beautiful communal situation in which we all help each other, but that ended up being something that even the guys on top didn't believe in anymore. At the end, they were all totally cynical, right? You can see in these communist societies. So the bonding was the police, and that's not what we want. So these societies in their own way break up. So we need to recover this kind of common ground and a common sense of mutual obligation, of solidarity, that we stand beside and behind each other.
Well, let me take a line that's come down from the 18th century on many of these issues, that if God did not exist, it would be necessary to invent him, which was a functional argument about religion. Yeah. That is, we actually do need religion of some sort.
Yeah.
Is that what you're arguing?
Well, it's, would you call it religion? I mean, it is a lay secular conception, right, by itself. But I think you're touching on something very important. Nobody has the kind of deep motivation to follow that unless it comes from deep within them, deep within what they consider to be the really important sources of morality. Now,
which takes us back to Kant in a way.
That's right. I mean, Kant had this idea of the awe we feel toward moral law and the awe we feel before that's the sort of translation of the German word. I think that's right, before the rational agent, right? So we're going to have people with very different deep gut convictions, some religious, some spiritual, some non-religious, non-spiritual, altogether agreeing on this general set of principles, the way we owe it to each other and so on. So it's going to be something very unlike what our ancestors were used to, where they always thought there's got to be a single, overarching, unifying, deep reason for doing what we're doing, which was in some religious form, right? Now, the thing about modern society is that's not possible anymore. I mean, even if everybody is very religious, they're going to be very religious in very different ways.
They're going to be
ways.
Spiritual.
Or spiritual, I mean, in such different ways. So there has to be this sense that wherever I'm coming from, I owe it to you as another human being. We're bonded together in society to stand beside you, stand behind you, make sure you get a break. So
this is a golden rule approach.
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's the center of it. But how to motivate that? See, golden rule is usually put negatively. Do not do unto others. Well, you could put it positively. Do unto others is the, okay. But it's not just refrain from harm. You've got to have this strong sense that you're my buddy.
That's been the key difficulty, though, isn't it? With any sort of set of ethical, moral demands, at any particular time, you've got to decide which side of the gap you stand on. Is this in my self-interest, or am I willing to sacrifice myself for the sake of someone else, even unto the point of my own life? Yeah. And at that point, the demand becomes something that people say, that is not something that individuals are consistently capable of.
Yeah,
and it's very hard to find anything outside of a sort of supra-governor who can encourage individuals to be prepared to make those sorts of sacrifices.
Well, you're pushing it too far. You're setting the bar too high, right? We're not asking the ordinary person to rush out and face the machine guns or the grenades and give their lives. I mean, some people will, and it's great. We're not asking the average citizen to do that. We're asking the average citizen to respond, even spontaneously, in solidarity with those who need. Now, you actually get a lot of that. But this is another thing I'd like to raise with you, because it's worrying for me. We're losing that. See, in 1956, I was involved in an organization helping Hungarian refugees. 200,000 came across the frontier after the Hungarian Revolution, suppressed by Russian tanks. And I worked for a few months in Vienna on that. The world stepped up to the plate. We had the job of finding among students and among the refugees and then finding scholarships, and we had the whole place cleared in a few months because the whole world was moved by that. They were willing to act. Why is it that today, when there's another refugee crisis, particularly Hungary, which was the beneficiary of that, but leave alone only Hungary, we aren't ready.
Is it because we've lost faith in institutions, particularly the critique that developed over multinational institutions like the United Nations over the last 40 years? Many of the criticisms of the UN were well-founded, but the idealism of FDR and the people who helped forge in that post-World War II era global institutions, even religious global institutions like the World Council of Churches and other bodies, that sense of global optimism is in profound retreat at the moment.
Yeah, maybe that's it. I mean, but does our spontaneous reaction to people in need depend on having an optimistic view of the future? If that's the case, we're in big trouble. But you still, you know, there still is this.
We're traveling down a vortex here.
No, you're getting me worried. No, where are we heading? No, but you think that when you show television footage of famine in Ethiopia, anyway, it used to be the case that people sent in their dollar, right? Mm-hmm. But now we've got something more immediate. I mean, in Australia, you're keeping these people at bay. I mean, you're keeping these refugees at bay, right?
Yeah, well, Canada let too many in too quickly. That's the view around here. We promised. Canada's taken in 29,000 or something. Australia promised 12,000. We haven't managed to get more than 30 or so.
Yeah. Well, you see that? Okay. The majority of us are proud of that. And that's a good thing. We had a government that was just like Australian government, keep them out, right? And that's one of the things that finally Canadians couldn't stand. They said, it's not us. And you know, this young prime minister, when he was elected, he said, Canada is back, right? The caring Canada. Now, we give ourselves too many pats on the back for this. But it's not a bad thing. I think people exaggerate it, but it's not a bad thing if you're proud of the fact that your country is got some sense of compassion.
So where do we find the new ties that bind? Where is the new relegare to be found?
Yeah. It's got to be found in the ideal of a society where we really respect each other, where we are free, where we govern each other. We have to refurbish that ideal. And it's I insist, it's very, very powerful because you regularly get rebellion by youth who feel we aren't living up to that, and they try to find a way of intervening.
It's been almost impossible for any society to establish that sort of coherence over any amount of time without some sort of sacramentalism associated with it. And you can even say that about the Nazis and the communists. Yeah. North Korea is a sacramental regime. We may find it pretty horrendous, but there is some sort of sacramental commitment there.
Yeah. But you see, the ritual, there's got to be some
kind
of ritual.
How do you find that in an utterly deracinated secular environment?
Well, you see, these moments when, Justin Trudeau went and met those first refugees, everyone, it's kind of something that everyone was participating in vicariously. And these ritual moments, and also ritual moments of the whole society, you need that to renew the sense of what the society is about. Human beings will never escape ritual.
So we need to have ritual and sacramental observance.
I mean, sacramental from a Catholic point of view, it doesn't go that far.
Well, small s.
Yeah, small s. Yeah. But we absolutely need that. And we need that around the right kind of principles and a sense of what we are together. And we need to constantly to renew that. So where I point I take from you, I think is very true, is that none of these solutions lasts forever, right? And the idea that we were all going to become democratic more and more and more just couldn't be true, because it's not just that we're having trouble spreading it, but it's decaying in its heartlands, modern democracy, right? It's decaying in the United States. It's decaying something in our country.
Because we've lost a sense of who we are, or lost confidence in who we are as individuals. Is that part of the problem?
Well, not as individuals, as a nation, see?
As connected individuals.
Their connectedness and a certain pride in being Australian, but which is focused around the things that really make for a valuable life and a valuable life together. And one of those things is solidarity. And if you just say that's not, it's not important, you're wasting your time, you're wasting your effort, your society as a democratic society will begin to crumble. It will be held together by the so-called market, which means that tremendous resources will flow to privilege and other people will not get their fair due. It can be held together by a dictatorship, in which case, you don't have freedom, or it can be held together by some renewal of this common bond.
It's an ideal as old as Rousseau, the social contract we're talking about here, essentially. What binds the social contract? For you find for yourself that religion, in the traditional sense, is a valuable source for you personally and for the world in which you operate. You're not saying that that form is necessary for everyone.
It can't be imposed and shared by everyone. And in the nature of things, as we see the development of the modern world, modern individualism, it's very unlikely that it'll ever be shared by everybody, right?
Are there any universals
in that realm? Well,
there are,
if you like, moral universals in that realm, But, and the forms of spiritual life, and I include people, atheists, who have some kind of depth and so on, forms of spiritual life which can nourish that are tremendously buried. And each one of us ought to be involved in deepening our own commitment, in my case, Christian Catholic, understand it better, understand it more deeply. And, you know, if you try to do that, you realize that you aren't very far along, that you're on a long journey, and you have respect for people, other people, who are on another kind of journey to find the sources of their life. And so that can become a new basis for living together in mutual respect.
If I take the Catholic tradition there, is this something that people are intuiting in somebody like Pope Francis, who tends to be saying, look, the doctrines are there, I recognize that, but the question is how you view them. Your attitude, I want to turn you from moral obligation to willful commitment, to voluntary. You look to your neighbor first.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rather than to look to right rules first.
Exactly. I mean, the Catholic Church under which I was brought up was getting sclerotic because it's entirely focused on a rule book, right? Particularly a sexual rule book, right? And that's what it's all about. And if you go and read the New Testament, that's not what it's all about at all. He's always stepping out.
You're not saying everything's relativized. You're not saying that. You're saying there are universals. How do you make judgments? I mean, well, what are the shared criteria? Because that, in a very narrow way, you could say it's between faith traditions. How do you make up the difference between a Buddhist and a Hindu or a Christian or whatever? But it's deeper than that. There are sort of profound senses of the pathway that you say is going to lead me towards some sense of absolute truth. Now, I don't want to put that in a sort of...
But, I mean, don't think only of truth because we're so far from the truth.
we grapple through the glass darkly.
Yeah, but, I mean, I'm held to my faith by the fact that it just might lead me to be more open, more loving, more able to transcend just being locked in myself. It's that which is... A very exciting sense that I get from it sometimes, that is something that can happen to me.
But you've made a decision, after some study, that the path you're on, it may be the path you were born into, but at some point you said, no.
Yeah.
It may be the path I'm born into, but actually there's a choice I need to make here.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is a truer path. Now, is that just a truer path for you, or are you saying this is something I recommend to others?
Oh, I mean, I see it having this power for me, I would certainly recommend it to others. But I'm not certain that it really suits everyone else. Only God knows how all this fits together, right? And, I mean, you've got to take very seriously, I think, the fact of being on a path. That is, I'm on a path, I'm not at the goal, right? I'm moving towards what I think is a truth, but I don't possess the truth. And I've got to become go as far as I can in this, and I think that's something that can serve the world. But and I've got to have respect for it and even exchange with others on other paths. But how it all fits together in the end, it's not given to me. God knows. As people say, God knows.
Charles Tudor, we're rapidly running out of time. But in the face of the problems the world is facing at the moment that we discussed at the opening of our conversation, what keeps you optimistic?
Yeah, I don't know. My friends say you're crazy, you're so optimistic. I just, maybe it's because I can't stand the world seen through the eyes of blackness and pessimism. I just feel so unhappy if that's how I, in the moments when I think, oh, we're going this way. So That's not a very good answer to your question.
But it's sort of transcendent optimism, really.
Well, yeah, it's a leap of faith. It's a leap of faith. We can somehow respond to this situation, get beyond it. And also, I mean, this great Marxist thinker Gramsci had another way of putting it. What was it? Pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will.
Charles Taylor, it's been great to have you as a guest on Sunday Night. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.